be a good one. Like Eileen Bradley. Stupid and well-intentioned and really selfish to be a good one. Probably I'm one already. They say you can't tell and that you always think you're not. There must be men who don't get tired of you or of it. There must be. But who has them? The ones we know are all brought up wrong. Let's not go into that now. No, not into that. Nor back to all those cars and all those dances. I wish that luminol would work. Damn, Eddie, really. He shouldn't have really gotten so tight. It isn't fair, really. No one can help the way they're built, but getting tight has nothing to do with that. I suppose I am a bitch, all right. But if I lie here now all night and can't sleep, I'll go crazy. And if I take too much of that damn stuff, I'll feel awfully all day tomorrow. And then sometimes it won't put you to sleep, and anyway, I'll be cross and nervous and feel frightful. Oh, well. I might as well. I hate to, but what can you do? What can you do but go ahead and do it, even anyway. Oh, he is sweet. No, he isn't. I'm sweet. Yes, you are. You're lovely. Oh, you're so lovely. Yes, lovely. And I didn't want to. But I am. Now I am, really. He is sweet. No, he's not. He's not even here. I'm here. I'm always here. And I'm the one that cannot go away. No, never. You sweet one. You lovely. Yes, you are. You lovely, lovely, lovely. Oh, yes, lovely. And you're me. So that's it. So that's the way it is. So what about it always now and over now, all over now? All right. I don't care. What difference does it make? It isn't wrong if I don't feel badly, and I don't. I just feel sleepy now, and if I wake, I'll do it again before I'm really awake. She went to sleep then, remembering, just before she was finally asleep, to turn on her side so that her face did not rest on the pillow. She remembered, no matter how sleepy, how terribly bad it is for the face to sleep that way, resting on the pillow. There were two other yachts in the harbor, but everyone was asleep on them too when the Coast Guard boat towed Freddie Wallace's boat, the Queen Conch, into the dark yacht basin and tied up alongside the Coast Guard pier. Chapter 25. Harry Morgan knew nothing about it when they handed a stretcher down from the pier, and with two men holding it on the deck of the gray-painted cutter under a floodlight outside the captain's cabin, two others picked him up from the captain's bunk and moved unsteadily out to ease him onto the stretcher. He had been unconscious since the early evening, and his big body sagged the canvas of the stretcher deeply as the four men lifted it up toward the pier. "Up with it now. Hold his legs. Don't let him slip. Up with it." They got the stretcher onto the pier. "How is he, doctor?" asked the sheriff as the men shoved the stretcher into the ambulance. "He's alive," said the doctor. "That's all you can say." "He's been out of his head or unconscious ever since we picked him up," the bosun's mate commanding the Coast Guard cutter said. He was a short, chunky man with glasses that shone in the floodlight. He needed a shave. "All your Cuban stiffs are back in the launch. We left everything like it was. We didn't touch anything. We just put the two down that might have gone overboard. Everything's just like it was. The money and the guns, everything." "Come on," said the sheriff. "Can you run a floodlight back there?"
"I'll have them plug one in on the dock," the dockmaster said. He went off to get the light and the cord.
"Come on," said the sheriff. They went astern with flashlights. "I want you to show me exactly how you found them. Where's the money?"
"In those two bags."
"How much is there?"
"I don't know. I opened one up and saw it was the money and shut it up. I didn't want to touch it."
"That's right," said the sheriff. "That's exactly right.
Everything's just like it was, except we put two of the stiffs off the tanks down into the cockpit so they wouldn't roll overboard, and we carried that big ox of a Harry aboard and put him in my bunk. I figured him to pass out before we got him in. He's in a hell of a shape."
"He's been unconscious all the time?"
"He was out of his head at first," said the skipper, "but you couldn't make out what he was saying.
We listened to a lot of it, but it didn't make sense. And then he got unconscious. There's your layout. Just like it was, only that niggery-looking one on his side is laying where Harry lay. He was on the bench over the starboard tank, hanging over the combing, and the other dark one by the side of him was on the other bench, the port side, hunched over on his face. Watch out. Don't light any matches. She's full of gas. There ought to be another body, said the sheriff. That's all there was. The money's in that bag. The guns are right where they were. We better have somebody from the bank to see the money opened, said the sheriff. Okay, said the skipper. That's a good idea. We can take the bag to my office and seal it. That's a good idea, said the skipper. Under the floodlight, the green and white of the launch had a freshly shiny look. This came from the dew on her deck and on the top of the house. The splintering showed fresh through her white paint. Astern of her, the water was a clear green under the light, and there were small fish about the pilings. In the cockpit, the inflated faces of the dead men were shiny under the light, lacquered brown where the blood had dried. There were empty 45 caliber shells in the cockpit around the dead, and a Thompson gun lay in the stern where Harry had put it down. The two leather briefcases the men had brought the money aboard in leaned against one of the gas tanks. I thought maybe I ought to take the money on board while we were towing her, the skipper said. Then I thought it was better to leave it just exactly like it was so long as the weather was light. It was right to leave it, the sheriff said. What's become of the other man, Albert Tracy, the fisherman? I don't know. This is just how it was, except for shifting those two, the skipper said. They're all shot to pieces except that one there under the wheel laying on his back. He's just shot in the back of the head. It come out through the front. You can see what it did. He's the one that looked like a kid, the sheriff said. He don't look like anything now, the skipper said. That big one there is the one had the submachine gun and who killed Attorney Robert Simmons, the sheriff said. What do you suppose happened? How the devil did they all get shot? They must have got fighting among themselves, the skipper said. They must have had a dispute on how to split the money. We'll cover them up until morning, the sheriff said. I'll take those bags. Then as they were standing there in the cockpit, a woman came running up the pier past the Coast Guard cutter, and behind her came the crowd. The woman was gaunt, middle-aged and bareheaded, and her stringy hair had come undone and was down on her neck, although it was still knotted at the end. As she saw the bodies in the cockpit, she commenced to scream. She stood on the pier, screaming with her head back, while two other women held her arms. The crowd, which had come close behind her, formed around her, jostled close, looking down at the launch. God damn it, said the sheriff. Who left that gate open? Get something to cover those bodies, blankets, sheets, anything, and we'll get this crowd out of here. The woman stopped screaming and looked down into the launch, then put back her head and screamed again. Where they got him, said one of the women near her. Where they put Albert? The woman who was screaming stopped it and looked in the launch again. He ain't there, she said. Hey, you, Roger Johnson, she shouted at the sheriff. Where's Albert? Where's Albert? He isn't on board, Mrs. Tracy, the sheriff said. The woman put her head back and screamed again, the cords in her scrawny throat rigid, her hands clenched, her hair shaking. In the back of the crowd, people were shoving and elbowing to get to the dock side. Come on, let somebody else see. They're gonna cover them up. And in Spanish, let me pass, let me look. Hay cuatro muertos. Todos son muertos. Let me see. Now the woman was screaming, Albert! Albert! Oh my God, where's Albert? In the back of the crowd, two young Cubans who had just come up and who could not penetrate the crowd stepped back, then ran and shoved forward together. The front line of the crowd swayed and bulged. Then in the middle of a scream, Mrs. Tracy and her two supporters toppled, hung slanted forward in desperate unbalance, and then, while the supporters wildly hung to safety, Mrs. Tracy, still screaming, fell into the green water, the scream becoming a splash and bubble. Two Coast Guard men dove into the clear green water where Mrs. Tracy was splashing in the floodlight. The sheriff leaned down on the stern and shoved a boat hook out to her, and finally, raised from below by the two Coast Guardsmen, pulled up by the arms by the sheriff, she was hoisted onto the stern of the launch. No one in the crowd had made a move to aid her, and as she stood dripping on the stern, she looked up at them, shook both her fists at them, and shouted,
bastards! Bitches!"
Then as she looked into the cockpit, she wailed,
"Alber! Where's Alber?"
"He's not on board, Mrs. Tracy," the sheriff said, taking up a blanket to put around her. "Try to be calm, Mrs. Tracy. Try to be brave."
"My plate,"
said Mrs. Tracy tragically.
"Lost my plate."
"We'll dive it up in the morning," the skipper of the Coast Guard cutter told her. "We'll get it all right." The Coast Guard men had climbed up on the stern and were standing dripping. "Come on, let's go," one of them said. "I'm getting cold." "Are you all right, Mrs. Tracy?" the sheriff said, putting the blanket around her.
"All right,"
said Mrs. Tracy.
"All right."
Then clenched both her hands and put her head back to really scream. Mrs. Tracy's grief was greater than she could bear. The crowd listened to her and was silent and respectful. Mrs. Tracy provided just the sound effect that was needed to go with the sight of the dead bandits that were now being covered with Coast Guard blankets by the sheriff and one of the deputies, thus veiling the greatest sight the town had seen since the Isleño had been lynched years before, out on the county road and then hung up to swing from a telephone pole in the lights of all the cars that had come out to see it. The crowd was disappointed when the bodies were covered, but they alone of all the town had seen them. They had seen Mrs. Tracy fall into the water, and they had, before they came in, seen Harry Morgan carried on a stretcher into the Marine Hospital. When the sheriff ordered them out of the yacht basin, they went quietly and happily. They knew how privileged they had been. Meanwhile, at the Marine Hospital, Harry Morgan's wife, Marie, and her three daughters waited on a bench in the receiving room. The three girls were crying, and Marie was biting on a handkerchief. She hadn't been able to cry since about noon. "Daddy's shot in the stomach," one of the girls said to her sister. "It's terrible," said the sister. "Be quiet," said the older sister. "I'm praying for him. Don't interrupt me." Marie said nothing, and only sat there, biting on a handkerchief and on her lower lip. After a while, the doctor came out. She looked at him, and he shook his head. "Can I go in?" she asked. "Not yet," he said. She went over to him. "Is he gone?" she said. "I'm afraid so, Mrs. Morgan." "Can I go in and see him?" "Not yet. He's in the operating room." "Oh, Christ," said Marie. "Oh, Christ. I'll take the girls home. Then I'll be back." Her throat suddenly was swollen hard and shut so she could not swallow. "Come on, you girls," she said. The three girls followed her out to the old car where she got into the driver's seat and started the engine. "How's Daddy?" one of the girls asked. Marie did not answer. "How's Daddy, Mother?" "Don't talk to me," Marie said. "Just don't talk to me." "But..." "Shut up, honey," said Marie. "Just shut up and pray for him." The girls began to cry again. "Damn it," said Marie, "don't cry like that. I said pray for him." "We will," said one of the girls. "I haven't stopped since we were at the hospital." As they turned onto the worn white coral of the rocky road, the headlight of the car showed a man walking unsteadily along ahead of them. "Some poor rummy," thought Marie. "Some poor goddamn rummy." They passed the man, who had blood on his face, and who kept on unsteadily in the dark after the lights of the car had gone on up the street. It was Richard Gordon on his way home. At the door of the house, Marie stopped the car. "Go to bed, you girls," she said. "Go on up to bed." "But what about Daddy?" one of the girls asked. "Don't you talk to me," Marie said. "For Christ's sake, please don't speak to me." She turned the car in the road and started back toward the hospital. Back at the hospital, Marie Morgan climbed the steps in a rush. The doctor met her on the porch as he came out through the screen door. He was tired and on his way home. "He's gone, Mrs. Morgan," he said.
"He's dead?"
"He died on the table."
"Can I see him?"
"Yes," the doctor said. "He went very peacefully, Mrs. Morgan. He was in no pain."
"Oh, hell,"
said Marie. Tears began to run down her cheeks.
"Oh," she said.
Oh, oh, oh.
The doctor put his hand on her shoulder.
Don't touch me, Marie said.
Then,
I want to see him.
Come on, the doctor said. He walked with her down a corridor and into the white room where Harry Morgan lay on a wheeled table, a sheet over his great body. The light was very bright and cast no shadows. Marie stood in the doorway looking terrified by the light. He didn't suffer at all, Mrs. Morgan, the doctor said. Marie did not seem to hear him.
Oh, Christ, she said, and began to cry again. Look at his goddamn face.
Chapter 26. I don't know, Marie Morgan was thinking, sitting at the dining room table. I can take it just a day at a time, and a night at a time, and maybe it gets different. It's the goddamn nights. If I cared about those girls, it would be different. But I don't care about those girls. I've got to do something about them, though. I've got to get started on something. Maybe you get over being dead inside. I guess it don't make any difference. I got to start to do something anyway. It's been a week today. I'm afraid if I think about him on purpose, I'll get so I can't remember how he looks. That was when I got that awful panic when I couldn't remember his face. I got to get started doing something no matter how I feel. If he'd have left some money or if there'd been rewards, it would have been better, but I wouldn't feel no better. First thing I've got to do is try to sell the house. The bastards that shot him. Oh, the dirty bastards. That's the only feeling I got. Hate and a hollow feeling. I'm empty, like an empty house. Well, I got to start to do something. I should have gone to the funeral, but I couldn't go. I got to start to do something now, though. Ain't nobody gonna come back anymore when they're dead. Him, like he was, snotty and strong and quick, and like some kind of expensive animal. It would always get me just to watch him move. I was so lucky all that time to have him. His luck went bad first in Cuba, and it kept right worse and worse until a Cuban killed him. Cubans are bad luck for conks. Cubans are bad luck for anybody. They got too many niggers there, too. Oh, I remember that time he took me over to Havana, when he was making such good money, and we were walking in the park and a nigger said something to me, and Harry smacked him and picked up his straw hat that fell off and sailed it about half a block and a taxi ran over it. I laughed so it made my belly ache. That was the first time I ever made my hair blonde, that time there in that beauty parlor on the Prado. They were working on it all afternoon, and it was naturally so dark they didn't want to do it, and I was afraid I'd look terrible, but I kept telling them to see if they could make it a little lighter, and the man would go over it with that orange wood stick with cotton on the end, dipping it in that bowl that had the stuff in it, sort of smoky-like the way it steams, sort of, and the comb, parting the strands with one end of the stick in the comb, and going over them and letting it dry. And I was sitting there scared inside my chest of what I was having done, and all I'd say was, just see if you can make it a little lighter. And finally he said, that's just as light as I can make it safely, madame. And then he shampooed it and put a wave in, and I was afraid to look even for fear it would be terrible. And he waved it parted on one side and high behind my ears, with little tight curls in back, and it's still wet, I couldn't tell how it looked. Except it looked all changed, and I looked strange to myself. And he put a net over it wet, and put me under the dryer, and all the time I was scared about it. And then when I come out from under the dryer, he took the net off, and the pins out, and combed it out, and it was just like gold. And I came out of the place, and saw myself in the mirror, and it shone so in the sun, and was so soft and silky when I put my hand and touched it. And I couldn't believe it was me, and I was so excited I was choked with it. I walked down the Prado to the cafe where Harry was waiting, and I was so excited, feeling all funny inside, sort of faint-like,
and he stood up when he saw me coming, and he couldn't take his eyes off me. And his voice was thick and funny when he said, 'Jesus, Marie, you're beautiful.' And I said, 'You like me, blonde?' 'Don't talk about it,' he said. 'Let's go to the hotel.' And I said, 'Okay, then, let's go.' I was 26 then. And that's how he always was with me. And that's the way I always was about him. He said he never had anything like me. And I know there wasn't any men like him. I know it too damn well, and now he's dead. Now I gotta get started on something. I know I got to. But when you got a man like that and some lousy Cuban shoots him, you can't just start right out, because everything inside of you is gone. I don't know what to do. It ain't like when he was away on trips. Then he was always coming back. But now I gotta go on the rest of my life. And I'm big now, and ugly, and old, and he ain't here to tell me that I ain't. I'd have to hire a man to do it now, I guess, and then I wouldn't want him. So that's the way it goes. That's the way it goes, all right. And he was so goddamn good to me, and reliable, too. And he always made money some way, and I never had to worry about money, only about him. And now that's all gone. It ain't what happens to the one gets killed. I wouldn't mind if it was me got killed. With Harry at the end there, he was just tired, the doctor said. He never woke up even. I was glad he died easy, because Jesus Christ, he must have suffered in that boat. I wonder if he thought about me, or what he thought about. I guess like that you don't think about anybody. I guess it must have hurt too bad. But finally, he was just too tired. I wish to Christ it was me was dead. But that ain't any good to wish. Nothing is any good to wish. I couldn't go to the funeral. But people don't understand that. They don't know how you feel. Because good men are scarce. They just don't have them. Nobody knows the way you feel. Because they don't know what it's all about that way. I know. I know too well. And if I live now 20 years, what am I going to do? Nobody's going to tell me that, and there ain't nothing now but take it every day the way it comes, and just get started doing something right away. That's what I gotta do. But Jesus Christ, what do you do at nights, is what I want to know. How do you get through nights if you can't sleep? I guess you find out, like you find out how it feels to lose your husband. I guess you find out, all right. I guess you find out everything in this goddamn life. I guess you do, all right. I guess I'm probably finding out right now. You just go dead inside and everything is easy. You just get dead like most people are most of the time. I guess that's how it is, all right. I guess that's just about what happens to you. Well, I've got a good start. I've got a good start, if that's what you have to do. I guess that's what you have to do, all right. I guess that's it. I guess that's what it comes to. All right. I got a good start then. I'm way ahead of everybody now.
Outside, it was a lovely, cool, subtropical winter day, and the palm branches were sawing in the light north wind. Some winter people rode by the house on bicycles. They were laughing. In the big yard of the house across the street, a peacock squawked. Through the window, you could see the sea looking hard and new and blue in the winter light. A large white yacht was coming into the harbor, and 7 miles out on the horizon, you could see a tanker, small and neat in profile against the blue sea, hugging the reef as she made to the westward to keep from wasting fuel against the stream.
To Have and Have Not was written by Ernest Hemingway and read by Will Patton. The recording engineer was Paul Fowley. Editing and post-production by Frog Pond Productions. Terry Hogan was the mix engineer. The associate producer was Travis Tunn. To Have and Have Not was produced and directed by Elisa Shokoff. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.